Direction today was by Julian Miller and the editor was Heba Ayoub. In this afternoon's episode of The Archers, there's bad news for Loxfest, but there's hope for the road protesters. That's in 15 minutes. But now on BBC Radio 4, Plants from Roots to Riches. Professor Cathy Willis, the Director of Science at the Royal Botanic Gardens Kew, continues her major history of our changing relationship with plants.
One of the most striking differences between animals and plants is that we have legs and wings, and they don't. We can move freely around the globe at will, while they are quite literally rooted to the spot. Well, not quite. There is one period of the life cycle of the plant during which it makes itself entirely portable, the seed. Seeds carry life to pastures new, allowing plants to spread, diversify, and survive. So important is this short-lived ability to move that they have evolved many ingenious ways of hitching a lift around the planet. By air, by water, by an animal.
Seeds can tell you an awful lot about a plant's lifestyle, if you like. They have evolved over many, many millions of years. If a seed does not work, the species goes extinct. So everything you see around today must somehow work. And that is surprising when you look at all those crazy shapes and sizes and colours you encounter in the wild.
That was Wolfgang Stuppi, a seed morphologist at Kew's Millennium Seed Bank. It was Russian botanist Nikolai Vavilov who pioneered the storing of seeds, collecting wild relatives of food crops in the first seed bank in St. Petersburg during the early 20th century. His concern was that selective breeding by farmers would diminish the natural store of genetic diversity. By the 1980s, scientific concern had also moved on to the fate of wild plants in their natural ecosystems. By 1992, the Rio Earth Summit on Sustainable Development concluded that conservation in the field needed to be complemented by methods away from a plant's natural habitat, such as seed banking. In the jargon, in situ protection in the field is matched with ex situ preservation in a seed vault.
It's not quite like Noah's Ark. It's a working collection for bona fide research.
Kew Seed Bank is housed at its country estate at Wakehurst Place in Sussex. It was opened in 2000 under the appropriate title Millennium Seed Bank. It's the largest ex situ plant conservation programme in the world, with the ambitious target of banking 25% of endemic and economically valuable plant species by 2020, and insurance against the risk of extinction in their native habitat.
Well, you can see we've got four cold rooms now. One is already full, two are nearly full. The fourth one is about ready to be switched on.
Once collected from their natural habitat, seeds are taken to the labs at Wakehurst, where they're slowly dried and cooled to slow the natural processes of deterioration. The ideal place to find dry air and constant low temperatures required is deep underground.
So it's freezing cold in here, even if Janet says it's not really. I think it is.
Janet Terry, head of seed preparation at the MSB, is my guide to this subterranean storehouse.
This is the final stage of preparing the seeds to go into the vault. So they've been cleaned, they've had an x-ray sample, they've had their seed numbers determined, then they come down into this room for a minimum of a month so that they will equilibrate to the same relative humidity as the room, as will all the containers that we're going to put the seeds into.
So then they go into these very large walk-in cold rooms.
This is it. This is what we called long-term storage. So the collections are designed to survive for tens, hundreds, thousands of years.
And how many species are in here now?
Over 30,000 species. And these cold rooms are the world's biggest biodiverse hotspot. So where you're standing now is the biggest plant hotspot on the planet.
Vavilov had really started something. There are now more than 1,300 seed banks all over the world. But the early pioneers of seed banking presented science with a series of challenges as well as opportunities. How long will each variety survive being kept? How do you wake up a seed following storage? Not all seeds can cope with being dried. Those that can vary enormously in how long they will last. A testament to the longevity of seeds are some that were germinated at Wakehurst. They got here by a typically roundabout route. They were collected from the Dutch East Indian Company gardens in South Africa by a Dutch merchant, Jan Tierlink, in 1803. Tierlink tucked 40 folded paper packets of seeds into a red leather wallet before boarding the good ship Henriette, bound for the Netherlands from its mooring in Cape Town. The Henriette was intercepted by the British and its cargo impounded. Tierlink was released but lost his precious red wallet full of seeds, which ended up with the rest of the booty in the Tower of London. Paul Smith, the head of the MSB, takes up the story.
After the Tower of London, they found their way to the Admiralty and then eventually to National Archives. So when National Archives said to us, "Do you think any of these seeds will still be alive?" we said, "Probably not. In fact, almost certainly not. But we will try to germinate this particular plant." And because we had a good name on it, we knew what it was, Leucospermum conocarpodendron, which is a plant from South Africa. We looked into our records and realized that this was one of those species that needs smoke to germinate the seed. And there's a specific chemical in the smoke that triggers germination, because this is a plant that comes up after fire in its natural habitat. And so having a competitive advantage by being triggered through smoke is the way that this plant gets ahead. So we applied a smoke solution. We use a solution rather than smoke. And to our surprise, our absolute shock, up it came. And because Jan Tierlink collected this seed more than 200 years ago, we have a perfectly healthy plant that we could test for pharmaceutical activity. We could put into horticulture, and it does have a beautiful flower. Or we can reintroduce back into the wild. So I had the pleasure of taking 10 cuttings from this plant back to South Africa last year for them to use and to reintroduce.
At the MSB at Wakehurst, 30,000 samples in store are tested regularly to check that they are still viable. Experiments are also conducted involving accelerating the ageing process in order to ascertain how long different seeds will remain viable under natural conditions. Paul Smith.
We stress the seed, we put it under conditions of high moisture and temperature, and we accelerate the aging process. And you can use a comparative methodology there to understand the comparative longevity of seeds. And that's been done with many agricultural species, for example. So sugar beet, apparently, sugar beet seed under those conditions can last for 10,000 years. For lettuce, it will be just a few hundred years.
But how do they work out 10,000 years?
Yeah, simply by, I guess, extrapolating back to the conditions under which we keep the seed and the rate of metabolism under those conditions compared to high temperature and humidity. But you're absolutely right. It really needs to be tested. I think the oldest seeds that we have in the seed bank are now over 40 years old. And so we're testing those every 10 years to see which ones are the most long-lived. And we are actually finding, again, that some seeds are comparatively short-lived. And we're working out why and what we need to look out for. So temperate species with small embryos, they tend to be shorter lived, so decades, hundreds of years, rather than thousands of years.
Knowing the quality and longevity of seeds is vital if they're to be put to good use in the real world. Particularly urgent is the need to examine their resilience to climate change. Scientists at the MSB have been investigating the impact of climate variability on seed quality, for example, by withholding water from sunflower fields and then examining the size of seeds and their ability to germinate. The potential economic and social impact of negative responses to environmental stress among food crops could hardly be more important. Hugh Pritchard is head of seed conservation research.
It could be that those environmental changes will affect one of the inherent properties of seeds that we can bank, and it could be that we're in for a nasty surprise that actually the seeds store less well as a result of that climate change. And one of our predictions is that the likely conditions in Europe, based on not Kew's work but the University of Reading, that the environmental conditions in Northern Europe will be more similar to Turkey or North Africa by 2060. And so what we're choosing from our collection of wild species are those which we have in the vault from those southern European locations, on the basis that we would anticipate that germplasm is already adapted to those environmental stresses. And then ultimately, of course, what we hope we would be arguing is that those species could indeed be the ones that contribute to improving the stress tolerance of the more frequently used northern European crops.
Because seeds can lie dormant in soil for a long time, they can survive many above-ground challenges, including fire, drought and freezing. Seeds are, in effect, the plant equivalent of a time capsule. It's this ability of seeds to lie dormant below ground that means that plants have incredible recovery potential despite human and climatic perturbations. It was once commented, if you go into a zoo and hammer all the animals on the head, you'd have the end of the zoo. In contrast, if you went into a botanic garden and scythed or burnt all the plants, 10 years later, you'd have a botanic garden again. Of course, neither course of action would be a very good idea, and I'd certainly be without a job. But the sentiment is correct. Plants can and do return from the dead via the seed bank. As a result of this process and some others, plants display incredible longevity. And what scientists are increasingly finding is that whilst the seeds are persisting, often the agents of dispersal of these seeds are not. Take the example of the world's biggest flower, the Rafflesia. Wolfgang Stuppi.
I've never read about it in the literature, who disperses the fruit or which animal. What I read was that somebody assumed it must be rodents because there was the only animals observed in Southeast Asia in the forest. You'd get all sorts of animals feeding on every kind of fruit. Yeah. That does not mean they are the co-adapted disperser. When I read the characteristics, how this fruit has this pulp that smells kind of yeasty inside. Now, when you go to Africa and you look at elephant dispersed fruits, they have this characteristic yeasty, not particularly pleasant smell. And then I immediately thought, it's the Asian elephant.
So the elephant likes that sort of smell. But there isn't an Asian elephant.
No, because the Asian elephant is an extremely endangered species and hardly present anymore in the habitats where you find Rafflesia. That disperser isn't there.
So what do you do at that point then? If the aim is to restore a species, but you no longer have its main herbivore disperser, How do we restore to those environments?
You either have to be a gardener for as long as you want this species to persist, basically until eternity or whatever, or you get the animal back.
Save the elephant means saving all the species that depend on the elephant too. Where elephants have disappeared, populations of plants which use them for seed dispersal have dropped by up to 95%. It's not that easy finding another animal willing to eat the fruit of the Rafflesia, the size of a grapefruit, with almost no flesh and a stone the size of a cricket ball.
Germination is basically reduced by 95% if you take the elephants away, because the pulp rots and destroys the seedlings or the embryos in the seeds. So it's a 95% reduction of the viability of those seeds, and everyone can imagine what that means for the population of that plant, apart from the fact that the seeds don't get to travel anymore. The seed is the only phase in the plant's life where it can travel.
Yeah.
And so it's a very crucial moment in the life of a plant, and that's why you have all these incredible adaptations to getting around somehow, one way or another, be it wind, water, animals, humans, you name it, everything.
There are many other examples across the world similar to this, where it's becoming increasingly apparent that it's not just the plant or even the population that we have to conserve. We also need to conserve the ecological processes associated with them, the whole ecosystem. As we'll hear, this involves a consideration of all aspects of biodiversity, from communities, populations, species, right down to the genes.
Plants From Roots to Riches was presented by Professor Kathy Willis. The producer is Adrian Washbourne. And an illustrated book to accompany the series, Plants From Roots to Riches, is now available to buy. Today's afternoon drama stars Julia McKenzie and Deborah McAndrew. Judith wants to get closer to her mother, but is too frightened to ask for the help she needs. Her mother, Anna, has a secret she's never shared with her daughter, and time is running out. When Judith becomes her mother's carer, their lack of communication intensifies. Nocturne by Margaret Wilkinson is in 15 minutes after The Archers. But now, a look ahead to Later Tonight with Peter Day.
For sheer entrepreneurial get-up-and-go, for decades there's been nowhere to touch Silicon Valley, California. But now that silicon has been replaced by software as the great engine of change, maybe the Valley is running out of steam. Hear what the Valley people think in Business this evening at 8:30.